Comments on Isaiah chapters 13 to 23, the 17th talk in a series on Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on November 18, 2012 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A handout, number one in the series, accompanies this talk.
For the last 8 or 9 weeks, we've been looking at a 10-chapter chunk out of Isaiah, and it's chapters 13 through 23, and in those chapters, there are 10 oracles. And the oracles are all some kind of vision that Isaiah has had with respect to one of the neighboring countries of Israel or of Judah. And they are all a bit ominous, but they are all difficult to sort out and difficult to understand. So I thought that I'd take some time to see if I can't bring together some of my ideas that have developed as I've worked through this section. And it's more talking about what kind of genre this is rather than specifically interpreting all of the passages, because it gets really difficult. I'd like to thank you for your patience and indulgence as we've gone through this. It is difficult for me to sort out. I think I'm making progress. In fact, I'm happy with the progress I've made, but it is still a very difficult section in which there are many, many things I don't understand. The first point is that it is very difficult to make sense of this book and this section in particular. I think I'm not the only one who has struggled. There are 4 or 5 commentaries that I use regularly, and they have been extremely helpful in providing historical information, grammatical information, suggestions on how different passages could be interpreted. All of that's been invaluable. But as far as understanding this whole section and what it's doing, I'm not convinced that they really have done that. It's really difficult to put together. Why is it so difficult to understand? First of all, there are 3 reasons, I think. The first is there's a lot of information that clearly has been lost to us. There is historical information. Some of the commentaries talk about various prophecies within this section having been fulfilled with an event for which we have absolutely no evidence. That doesn't mean that's not true. It could be that prophecy was fulfilled by an event in the 700s BC that we have no evidence of. That could very well be. But clearly, there's a lot of information that's been lost. We just don't have it, a lot of historical information, as well as cultural information that we don't have that helps us make sense of some of the expressions that are used and some of the references that are made, as well as linguistic information, meanings of words and phrases that have been lost to us. The second is the genre itself is hard to interpret. It is very poetic. It is image-based. It's evocative language. It's impactful, but it is not, I'm not sure this is quite the right word, but there's a sense in which it's not precise. The third thing that I would point out, and I think it's related to the previous one, and that is there are a lot of textual variants in this section. By that, what I mean is we have ancient copies of the book of Isaiah, but those copies are not always exactly the same. There are some differences between the copies that we have, even the ancient copies that we have. That's what I mean by textual variants. And I have never studied a passage where there are more textual variants than we've encountered in the last 10 chapters of Isaiah. I think that's because it's hard to understand. Many years ago, I collected some chain letters. I got a chain letter or two, and they were very similar. And I thought, well, this is interesting. These are obviously, they started from the same source, but they're different. So I thought I'd start collecting them. And I told other people that I was collecting them, and they gave me some. And I ended up with about 10 copies of a letter that obviously had a single source. But they were all different. And I thought, this would be a great little experiment in looking at textual variants, because that's what happens is a text is copied, and when it's copied, mistakes are made, changes are made. Most of them probably inadvertent, some of them possibly intentional, it's hard to say. But in general, the ancient text, the ancient copyists were quite conscientious in trying to convey the text just as they had received it. Well, in looking at these letters, one of the things that popped out at me is the kinds of information that were most likely to get scrambled were numbers. Numbers first, and then the second most likely was names. And it occurred to me that that makes good sense, because most numbers in a context could be different and no one would ever notice. You could swap digits in a number and no one would ever notice. The copyist would never have any idea that that has happened. If you get letters swapped around in words, somebody's apt to notice and know how they need to be changed to go back. So some kinds of information are more likely to get changed. And in this section, Isaiah, it is highly poetic. It's hard to follow the context. It's the kind of section of text that I think is more easily garbled because there's no self-correcting mechanism there. Does that make sense to you? Do you see what I'm saying? I think that's why there are so many textual variants in this section. Okay. I'm going to make a few observations about the difficulty of determining when a predictive prophecy has been fulfilled. This is stuff that I've been reflecting on and trying to sort out as we've been working through Isaiah. The first is it's figurative language. Oftentimes it's figurative language. It is hard to know as you're reading through this section what is meant to be figurative and what is not meant to be figurative. In one of the commentaries that I've been using, a commentary by John Oswalt, in the chapter chapter 19, where it's talking about Egypt, and in that oracle, it talks about Egypt's having civil war, you'll recall. And then it talks about the Nile drying up and the economy going to pot. And then the third section talks about the rulers losing all their common sense and not knowing what to do. And Oswalt, quoting a commentator from the late 1800s, said something that was very striking to me. Alexander, this is the commentator who wrote about over a century ago, Alexander is surely right when he says that the picture is metaphorical, as one would speak in a metaphorical way of Britain's demise by saying that her navy is sunk, her universities are empty, her throne abandoned, without any of those being literally true. And that was striking to me. I think what he's saying there is true, that you could describe an England that is completely destroyed, that's not a functioning society anymore, by saying that her navy is sunk, her universities are empty, her throne abandoned, and yet none of those be literally true. So that makes it tricky. It's hard to know when a section in Isaiah is intended to be figurative and when it is not. Another thing that's tricky, and this is with respect to figurative language as well, figurative language is designed to convey an impression rather than empirical data. And I've got an example here. I ran into her at the store, but she was cold as ice. Now, she's not literally cold. Everyone knows that I'm probably not intending that this person is literally cold. But cold as ice is an analogy that's being used to help me understand the something about this encounter. But what's interesting is the listener has been told absolutely nothing objective about the meeting. You don't know a single objective fact about the meeting. So if I were to ask you to draw a picture of that meeting, you would be without a clue as to how to do that. You would just be making it up. The listener has only been told that the meeting was a very unfriendly, unwelcoming encounter. That's what the phrase cold as ice is conveying, that it's that kind of unwelcoming encounter. So I know that about that, and that's very important information. And that fact, that may be more important information than any empirical facts that could be told about the meeting. But the reality is, I know nothing. I don't know a single empirical fact about that meeting. The third thing that makes this predictive prophecy difficult is the chronology is not of concern to the author. And I've pointed out before, and I think this is really true, from God's perspective, from eternity, chronology isn't all that significant. It's not all that important. And as a result, when God is talking about events on earth, chronology is not a big deal to him. And as I've reflected on this in the section of Isaiah, it's occurred to me that one of the difficulties with chronology is that widely spaced events, if you look at them from a long enough distance, they can be seen to be connected in ways that might not otherwise be apparent. I've got an example. Let's talk about the Revolutionary War in America and the Civil War. Historians now see those as connected events. How are they connected? They're connected in that much of the fighting was actually over the same kinds of issues. In the Revolutionary War, the Americans went to war over issues of freedom. They wanted to be free, and free in a sense that they had not been. And they wanted to establish an order that was in which there was political equality for all of its citizens. The Civil War was actually a war that was fought over those same unresolved issues. That is, what does it mean to be free? What does it mean to be in a union, in a governmental union with other people, and yet be free? How does that work out? And what does it mean for every citizen to be politically equal? And what constitutes a citizen, and who should be a citizen, and what is that equality, etc. So you can see how there are very similar issues just being worked out at a different level in the Civil War from in the Revolutionary War. So historians talk about those two wars as being an event. The fact that they're separated by 80 years is not all that significant. They are still an event. So, with that in mind, as I've looked at some of the passages in this section in Isaiah, I think some of the same phenomenon might be occurring. Let me illustrate this with, I wrote four lines of scripture. I don't know where it'll be used, but I tried to imitate the Old Testament language. I've even used chiastic constructions. Do you know what a chiastic construction is? A chiastic construction is where you've got element A and B, and then your next line starts with B and then goes to A. So I've done some chiastic constructions, and I've also tried to do two parallel statements, which is very common in the Old Testament. So you can appreciate my artistry. But what I wrote is, mother's sons fought to death in defense of freedom. Even equality led armies to meet in bloody battles. The battlefields were strewn with bodies cloaked in scarlet and in blue. Blood saturated coats of blue and of gray covered the soldiers' corpses scattered on the ground. Okay, that's my feeble attempt to try to suggest how it could be possible that you could have elements of the Revolutionary War and elements of the Civil War all conveyed in the same brief passage because it's the same event. If that's true, and to the extent that that's true, from eternity, there are events in human history that are separated by millennia, but nevertheless closely connected. I think that's true. And as a result, that means that there's the potential in predictive prophecy for it to get really tricky to sort out the chronology if the author is looking at something that's spread over a very wide span of time as a single event. The fourth thing that makes this very difficult to interpret is the phenomenon of typology. I've talked about this phenomenon before. As I understand it, human history, the history of mankind on this earth, is God's magnum opus. It's his master novel. And it is, as such, very carefully crafted, and I think that is genuinely true. And in so crafting it, he has written some events which occur early in history to foreshadow events that are going to come later in history. And the more I've looked at the Old Testament texts, the more frequently I think I see that phenomenon. One of those is one that we've already looked at in Isaiah, in chapter 7 of Isaiah, where the birth of Emmanuel is proclaimed, is predicted. And that foreshadows the birth of Jesus, according to Matthew. So let's look at that just very briefly. What specifically was predicted with respect to Isaiah's son, Emmanuel? There are four things that can be pulled out. One was that a child was to be born. The second is that that child would be born to a young, unmarried woman. And the Septuagint version uses a word that suggests a virgin will be the mother of the child. The third is that this child will be given the name Emmanuel, and Emmanuel, by the way, means God with us. And the fourth is that before he knows right from wrong, right and wrong, Aram and Israel will be conquered. So those are the things that are predicted with respect to the child that was going to be born and presumably the one born to Isaiah in 700 BC. Emmanuel, then, was the foreshadowing of Jesus the Messiah. And what happens there? First, the Messiah was born as a child. Second, he was born not just to a young unmarried woman, but more spectacularly, he was born to a virgin. The third, he was not given the name Emmanuel, at least as far as I know, but he was more truly God with us. Fourthly, Aram and Israel were not conquered again. Okay. So, in what happened with the birth of Jesus, it was not a replication of the original event, an exact replication. It was an event that bore some similarities, and where it was similar, it was more profound. It was more profoundly true than was the birth of Emmanuel in 700 BC. And the question is, to what extent is typology being introduced in these predictions made by Isaiah? In what instances are the things that are being predicted foreshadowing another event that will come along later? It is my suspicion that when we see in the prophetic prophecy claims with respect to the event at hand that are grand, that may be suggesting that a more profound filling out is yet to come. In any case, these four features of predictive prophecy make envisioning predicted events virtually impossible, it seems to me. Because you don't know when it's figurative and when it's not figurative. It's not clear. And what is the nature of the relationship of the figurative language to the thing that's actually going to happen? Is it just the feeling that we will get when that happens? Or is it telling us something more concrete? When is typology at play? And how do we put together the chronology? Okay. So, if what we have here is predictive prophecy, but it's really difficult to envision what is being predicted, then of what value is it? What's it here for? And I'd never thought about this in this way before. And as I began to think about this, it occurred to me that my assumption has been that predictive prophecy is there in order to impress the reader with God's knowledge of the future. It's there to show us that God knows what's coming up. I'm rethinking this assumption at this point. If we think about the predictions that were made with respect to Jesus, were those impressive? Were we given the kind of detail about the birth of Jesus that people look at it and they say, oh my goodness, God obviously knew what was coming up long before it happened? Did they help people to identify the Messiah when he came? Did they compel people to accept him because he had been predicted from long before? Were they not easily misunderstood? The picture, the dominant picture at the time when Jesus came, of what it would happen when the Messiah came, is that there would be this political leader that would come along, rise up, and help Israel to overthrow its enemies. That's not what happened. People were surprised. People looked at Jesus and they said, you can't be him, because he didn't match the prophetic picture that they had developed. It seems to me the prophetic prophecy is not intended to convince the skeptical. Prophetic prophecy has not been given to us to overwhelm us with the sense, oh my goodness, God does know what's coming. One of the things that has been striking to me in Isaiah and very sobering to me is that God keeps insisting that it's not his dramatic works that he is interested in bestowing on us to gain our allegiance. It is his work in the ordinary and the mundane that is there for everyone to see, and there's plenty of that there to be compelling with respect to who God is and what he's up to. The people of Israel wanted something more dramatic. The mundane wasn't compelling. And I love this verse in Isaiah 8, 6 and 7. Inasmuch as these people have rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloah, now therefore, behold, the Lord is about to bring on them the strong and abundant waters of the Euphrates. And the context here being, they had taken for granted the provision that God had made, the stream of Shiloah, the water coming from the spring of Gihon that had provided them water for centuries in Jerusalem. And they took that for granted. And as a result, God's response was going to be to bring on them the strong and abundant waters of the Euphrates, that is, the Assyrians were coming. God expects us to see him in the ordinary. And I think it's interesting, that makes sense to me then, makes sense of a verse in Matthew 12:39, when Jesus said, an evil and adulterous generation craves for a sign, and yet no sign shall be given to it but the sign of Jonah the prophet. That they wanted a sign, they wanted dramatic evidence that God was, well, they wanted evidence that Jesus was the Messiah. And Jesus said, none will be coming. From God's perspective, it seems to be the case that God has acted dramatically in history. He acted dramatically, in particular, in the Exodus. And that's a time that the authors of the Old Testament keep pointing back to. That God acted overtly in history in a way that you could see that his hand was at work. But after the Exodus and the conquest, God, for the most part, backed off and has not been active in the events of history, at least not in a way that's overt and obvious. He expects us to see him in the mundane and in the ordinary. So if predictive prophecy is not there to impress us with God's knowledge of the future or to convince the skeptical, what is it there for? And I think it's there to reassure the faithful. It's not there to tell us exactly what's going to happen, but it gives us a general idea of what God is up to in history. For instance, in this section, it helps us to understand the suffering of Israel over the years, over the centuries. It helps us to understand how the malicious can nevertheless be agents of God. How people like the Assyrians could be the tool of God and yet be such a nasty people. It reassures us that things are proceeding as God planned, even when it doesn't look like it. I was trying to think of an analogy, and this is an analogy that doesn't entirely work, but it's kind of like an interview of an author of a book that's just come out. The author is not going to tell you what happens in the books. The author doesn't want to spoil the book for you. But the author will probably tell you what themes to look for. What is this book about? And what kinds of things should you be looking for when you read it? There's a sense in which God has told us how it ends. In very broad terms, God has told us how it ends. But many of the details, I think, are left unclear. We don't know what's going to happen. Okay, what is the nature of predictive prophecy in Isaiah then? Especially this section of Isaiah. First of all, it is not a history of the future. That's a term that we came up with, a group of us, when we were studying Isaiah last year, and I think it's helpful. It is not as though Isaiah is writing a history of the events to come, like a history book would present them. It's not a history of the future. It's not detailed, clear, precise. It is rather impressionistic. I suspect that it cannot be broken down piece by piece. It's like an impressionistic painting, where if you try to focus on the details, you'll never be able to figure out what's going on. You have to stand way back and look at the whole picture. And when you look at the whole picture, then you can tell what's going on. But if you were just to zoom in on the dots on the canvas without looking at the whole thing, you'd never know what's going on there. Chronology seems to be of little concern. So a single passage can contain references to events widely spread in time. There seems to be typological relationships being alluded to. It's hard to sort out exactly what those are. But I think that the predictive prophecy in these chapters is a mixture of predictions of events foreshadowing eschatological events and predictions of eschatological events themselves, that the two are woven together. And that the invasions that begin with the Assyrian invasions in 720 and then go all the way through till the Babylonian invasions and then the defeat of the Babylonians by the Persians, it seems to me that that is all kind of being looked at as though it's one event. And that that event constitutes a dress rehearsal for an eschatological filling out of what happens there. Some of the features of that period of time, that event, one, it affected the entire known world of the Israelites. Two, it was cataclysmic and destructive. Third, it was a complete transformation of the whole ancient Near East. And fourthly, it was clearly divinely ordained. And I think what we're led to understand in Isaiah is that the end time will witness a similar kind of tumult. Okay, if that's true then, what is that impressionistic picture that's being presented? So what I've done here is I've taken the themes that keep repeating themselves in these 10 chapters and tried to describe that whole thing. And I'll just go through these quickly. I have them pretty well all listed up there. The first is, there is a great judgment coming. It's a worldwide judgment. It will be punishment for evil. It will be directed towards Israel first, but also then to the rest of the world. The third, the agent of this judgment will be manifold. In some cases, it is nature, but there are several references to armies of many nations. Fourth, it will be so horrible that people will be struck numb. Their knees will go weak as they see this develop. There will be great destruction and loss of life. There's several references to burning and many references to great loss of life. And sixth, apparently it will sneak up on people, catch them unawares. Second feature, nothing will provide security from this judgment and God's wrath. First, no fortresses or military will be safe. Second, no amount of money will save people. Third, no country will be spared. No God or religion will provide protection. But the proud will be brought low. Anything that people have relied upon in place of God, it will be shown to not be able to withstand the test of this onslaught. And God alone is the one willing and able to save us. The third, there will be a restoration of Israel. Israel will be freed from its oppression at the hands of its enemies. The authority of rulers will be broken. Israel will take its place at the center of the world, both politically and religiously. And God will be at peace with Israel. All of this has constituted a disciplining of Israel that finally is going to turn their hearts. And they will embrace him wholly. Fourth, there is hope for other peoples. There will be a striking but a healing with respect to the peoples. That is, they will be judged, there will be destruction, but it will be of such a nature and orchestrated in such a way that there will be a turning of the hearts of other peoples. There are several suggestions, though, that it will just be a remnant of those countries. They will worship God in Jerusalem. They, too, will become God's people in a way that's similar to the way that Israel is God's people. And ultimately, there will be world peace. And the last feature of this impressionistic picture, God planned it all. From the very beginning, this was all what God had planned to carry out. He had orchestrated every aspect of it. And in so doing, he is accomplishing all of the purposes that he has set out to accomplish. Nothing is out of his control. Okay. In conclusion, I can't tell you how the end will look, certainly based on Isaiah 13 through 23. Now, it could be that there are other prophetic passages that make it clearer. But based on that, I can't tell you how the end will look or when it will be. I can only tell you how it will turn out in the most general of terms, and that's what I have tried to do. I suspect, I don't know this for sure, but I suspect that the end will not look like the popular schemes that depict it. This is no slight to those who have tried to put it together. It's very difficult to put together. But I suspect it won't turn out like any of those schemes. Why? I'm just taking it from the fact that the first coming of Jesus didn't look like people thought it would. Why would his second? The other thing that leads me to think that that might be the case is there are a number of times in the New Testament when we are warned that there will be few that keep the faith. And I think part of that is it's not going to look like what we thought it would look like. And speaking of that, the most difficult thing as we wind down in history is going to be to keep the faith. That's going to be our job. And I suspect that God will continue his pattern, that for the most part, he will not be providing signs. For the most part, he's not going to act overtly. I suspect that he will, to a certain extent, act overtly in history sometime in the end, really close to the end. But for the most part, I suspect that he will not. And that what we will have to do is what the people of Judah were called upon to do in the time of Isaiah. And that is to recognize in the mundane and in the ordinary God's regular care and concern for us. That we need to recognize and acknowledge and be thankful for the gently flowing streams of Siloam. Okay, those are my thoughts and reflections on this section in Isaiah. I hope that's helpful. I wish I could be more specific. I wish I could tell you what's going to happen. I wish I could tell you when all of those little pieces in Isaiah were fulfilled or what they'll look like when they are fulfilled. I cannot do that. But I've just in thinking about what is the nature of prophetic prophecy, I have found it interesting, and I hope this is helpful for you. There is time. We've got about 20-some minutes for any questions or comments.
Well, thank you very much, David, and I especially want to thank you for those lines of scripture that you wrote. I'm sure I speak for all of us in saying we look forward to your next installment of scripture. So when you were making that point about the U.S. Civil War and the U.S. Revolutionary War, and what I thought I heard you say was historians connect them and kind of think of them. Did you say something along the lines of kind of the same struggle?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I'm trying to connect that, and I'm sure you said this and I just didn't quite catch it, but as it relates to what, in this case, Isaiah was doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's why you brought up the analogy. Are you saying that Isaiah was similarly connecting, I don't know how to say it, near-term events and farther down the road events,
mm-hmm.
sort of?
Mm-hmm.
My question is somewhere around here. Is it that Isaiah had both things in mind, or B, Isaiah looked at both things and combined them, or three, there was some kind of double fulfillment,
mm-hmm.
or four, none of the above?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I'm thinking is there are passages where you have statements made that sometimes seem to refer to a near-term event, seem to be fulfilled in a near-term event, and yet other passages, other statements in that same passage referring to things that were not fulfilled in that near-term event and seem to be talking about something at the end of time. Let me see if I could think of a good analogy. Let's say in raising my children that I have the same goals over a long period of time with respect to what I want to achieve in their lives. But some of that happens when they're young and some of that happens when they're much older. But it's all the same process. I could talk about events early and events late all mixed together because it's all the same process. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's all one event. Similarly, it seems to me that from God's perspective, there could be things happening in the time of Isaiah that is God's working in history and achieving, working towards his purposes, and events that are things that he does much later in history, maybe even at the end of time, that are all part of that same process. And so it all gets talked about as if it's one thing. And I'm wondering if that doesn't account for why we've got this apparent conglomeration of things talking about near-term events and longer-term events. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
Thank you. And so it's not really, in my mind, it's not really double fulfillment exactly. It's just seeing things from such a long distance that widely spread events are really intimately connected in one thing.
That's helpful. Thanks. And it's been a long time since I've studied history, but I did in college, and I didn't realize that historians viewed those two U.S. wars as linked.
That's probably in more recent times. No comment on your age, but
62.
but in more recent years, that's the way they've been seeing them.
But pretty broadly, I mean, that's how most...
That's pretty common,
No kidding.
And it's on the analogy of World War One, World War II. I mean, World War One, World War II, the connection is more clear.
Right.
And they aren't spread by as many years. But it is similar issues that are being worked out in both of those wars. And then by analogy, looking at the Revolutionary War and the Civil War, it's the same kind of phenomenon.
Well, yeah, I guess we're not here to talk about that, I guess, but that was interesting. The combatants were different, though.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And the same in World War One and World War Two. I mean, the people are different.
Mm-hmm. Well.
Who's fighting against whom?
Yeah.
To a certain extent, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
David, I know you very clearly and explicitly said that you didn't want to go into detail.
Right.
But...
And I meant it.
Just curious. Several weeks ago, you, and I don't want to mischaracterize what you were saying, so you can correct me if and when I do that. You seem to be suggesting that rattling around in your mind was the possibility that that there might be something in the hostility of Islam to the West that might be part of this big picture, and especially maybe even right now, this week, this weekend, in light of what's going on in Israel and all that sort of thing. Do you want to comment on that, or do you want to distance yourself from that comment? Or?
I'll do both. As I've argued, I think it's virtually impossible to envision, on the basis of this predictive prophecy, what things are going to look like at the end. Having said that, however, we do have this impressionistic picture. And as we look at the world as it exists today, and then we look at this impressionistic picture, it seems to me that there are some dynamics at work in what's happening today that could account for some features in this impressionistic picture. Whether that's the way it will play out or not, whether we're even in end times or not, I don't know for sure. But if we're getting anywhere close, and if my impressionistic picture is right, then I think the dynamics are set for some of that picture to be realized, and the world of Islam would play a big role in that. It seems to me. That's basically what I'm arguing.
And I appreciate your saying that the impression that you have is that the popular depiction of what might happen might very well be wrong, but basically the overall impression you have still is God's going to take care of his own. I mean, God will take care of those whose hearts are turned to him. He will turn the hearts of some faithful remnant in Israel, and some others will, in fact, be faithful as well and associated as well. Is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. God will look out for Israel. I'm confident of that. Now, does that mean that the Israelites living in Palestine right now will never be driven out of Palestine again? I don't know that I can say that for sure. Right.
We don't know that it's the geopolitical state of 2012 that is being talked about there. Right.
But I think it's quite clear from Scripture that God will look out for Israel, and it will not disappear. It will continue to exist, and at some point, it will turn to God. And as I'm understanding it, in this tumult at the end of times, that there will be something about that tumult that is going to turn the hearts of remnants in other countries as well, that it won't just be the Jews that whose hearts are turned. But how that'll happen and whether that's before Jesus comes another time and all that sort of thing, I do not know.
It has been rolling around for a little while that if what I've heard you say before is that Israel's going to survive and the rest of the world's going to get trashed to some extent or other. And I've been thinking that the best place for my children and grandchildren and stuff would be to be in Israel. And so to move, what I ought to do is move to Israel and live there and survive and so on. And your point up there about other people also being a remnant for them too.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first time I'd heard that. Hmm. And I wondered where you'd come up with that.
Well, I didn't write down the passages, but there are two suggestions of remnants. Well, Moab, in the oracle with respect to Moab, and then in the oracle with respect to, is it Egypt? Where it talks about the highway that's built from Egypt to Assyria and Assyria to Egypt, and they're connected with Israel. So there are at least two of those nations where it specifically talks about a remnant that worships in Jerusalem. And I think my guess is that will be true of other nations as well. Now, whether you should move to Israel or not, I'm not sure that God will protect his people. I'm not sure that that means that Israel will be at peace till the end of time.
But it seems like if the picture is that the rest of the world starts getting blacker and blacker and Israel's virtually the only point of light, that it would be best for the Hobbes to be there in that point of light instead of in the darkness.
Mm-hmm. Having grown up in the church, I can hear the church culture of know-it-all walking out of here, shaking their heads like, he doesn't know anything. These people refuse to see the obvious truth, and then they'll go home and they'll watch, what's that movie series? Left Behind, yeah. And then they'll go find an old copy of the late great Planet Earth and watch that too. And they're like, it's clear. It's all right there, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's not. I mean, the older I get and the more honest I am as I think I interact with the writings of the prophets, I go, boy, it's not. And my frustration is that I would assume that any communication from God should be illustrative and instructional, and it should be enlightening. Mm-hmm. He wants us to know.
Mm-hmm.
And so have we lost so much contact with the ancient world that it has now, that the prophecy have now become something like out of Lord of the Rings, where it's now a riddle. It's a puzzle. It's actually written so that you won't know it until it's time, right? There'll be some, massive landslide will fall away from a cliff and there'll be a hieroglyph revealed. Oh, now we know what it means. That was hidden. That's the key that unlocks. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I find that very frustrating and puzzling. because there is the statement by Jesus where he says he lays it out clearly, and yet they don't hear, they don't see. Only because that's the purpose, is to show that they don't really want to know. Mm-hmm. This stuff, I think we really want to know. And it's so opaque that it makes me wonder how much effort should we really give to it if we have lost touch with the ancient world to that degree and can't know.
Well, I think that there's much to be gained from looking at this stuff quite apart from its predictive value, insofar as giving us a sense of what God is doing, why he's doing it, what he values and what he doesn't value. All of that's really important. And it's really important for us to keep in mind that God does want to illuminate our minds, but he wants to illuminate it with what he wants to illuminate it with. And for us to want to have our minds illuminated, but we only want it to be illuminated in certain ways, in certain aspects, that's not our privilege. So the question is, we want to be open, we need to be open to what he wants to tell us, not to what we want to know. And I think it probably is the case that if we're familiar with these passages, that as they are fulfilled, then all of a sudden what is figurative and what is literal is going to become apparent, and that things are going to kind of fall together, and we're going to go, oh my goodness, that's what it was talking about. So I think that these will end up being quite predictive, but I think we need to be really flexible until the event that is being predicted actually happens. Because otherwise we're going to have an image of what we think is going to come, and what's coming won't match it.
Were the radical biblicists right about Jesus and the cultural Jews wrong?
What do you mean?
Well, were the people who recognized Jesus, was that because they had the proper view of their scripture? They were radical biblicists. And the people who didn't get Jesus were the people who had imbibed the cultural milieu, the religious cultural milieu, which had reinterpreted everything and created this edifice of a worship, of a religion. And they were just swimming in that.
Right.
So he didn't appear on their radar.
I think so. The way I think about it is the people that recognized Jesus were the ones who best knew who God is. And what I mean by that is they knew what kind of character God has. And so when that was embodied in a human being, they look at Jesus and they say, oh my goodness, I recognize him. I've seen him before. Whereas those who have their charts out and have figured out all of prophecy and what's going to happen and where it's going to happen and where's the Messiah going to be born and what's he going to do and where's he going to, well, he won't, probably won't die. But they've tried to chart out all those passages, and yet when God is standing before them, they can't even recognize him because their charts and stuff don't match what's happening. So what I think the problem was, there were people who were focused on the wrong thing. And as a result, and they got stuck on that picture of what it's going to be like when the Messiah comes, and it didn't match it. But those who were focused on who God is, when he's standing in front of them, they say, well, I didn't think it was going to happen this way, but that's got to be him. And I think that's what happened.
I'm pretty afraid to sound pretty simplistic in this crowd, but I'd like to cut to the chase where it says, we're asked to do a very difficult thing to keep the faith. Are we speaking individually or as Christ Church, as we see so many different styles and emphases on what's important in worship, and we get away from knowing who Christ is? Is that, are we talking about, like Peter, when Christ was killed, we will say, well, we didn't know him, and that's falling away from the church? Or is this more of, we're finding fewer and fewer churches that point to the cross and more point to what we want to feel?
Mm-hmm. Well, I see the issue of the church as being a symptom of the problem of individuals not keeping the faith. So it ultimately it comes down to us as individuals. That is, what should we do? What are we called to do as things get difficult, as the world becomes chaotic, and as things become obscured, that is, the reality of things becomes obscured, that is, God's working in the world becomes obscured. And the only answer I know to give to that is, God help me. Because I can't manufacture, there's nothing I can do to manufacture that faith. All I can do is turn to God and say, I want to trust in what is true. I want to be faithful to what is true. And this is a confusing and complicated world. Please help me to do that. And it's keeping that pure spirit that I think is absolutely critical. And then drawing on what it says in what Isaiah is talking about, especially in those first few chapters of Isaiah, where God is critical of the people of Judah because they're not as smart as the dumb animals who knows who feeds them. Recognizing God being at work in the ordinary and mundane, I think, is absolutely critical. There are so many ways on a daily basis that he is taking care of us if we're just attentive to it and willing to believe that God is at work.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.